and I'll have it closer to you than to me. So. I'd like to have some information about the new great boycott that I have not gotten yet. I'd like to know, for instance, if it's going to be of all grapes, all fresh grapes.
Yes, it's all fresh grapes except that small percentage which is under contract.
Mm-hmm.
And even that, you know, it's 3% when we talk about Coachella, which will be ending in about another 2 weeks,
mm-hmm.
3 weeks maybe. And then after that, it's probably less than 1% of those grapes under contract.
Yeah.
The, you sorry with the train?
That's okay.
Okay. The, but even may not even be 3% because I think we've caught one of the growers over there cheating and lending already the union label to another grower. You hear that, Chris? I think we've caught a grower, the only two growers we have over there, one of them. I think we caught him cheating and letting the union label to another big grower.
Who is that?
That's
Friedman.
We're not sure, but it's, you know. If, so if that happens, the language is it's written so we can yank the label,
mm-hmm.
and maybe even boycott these grapes.
Mm-hmm.
So the latest report that we got, and I'm going to go ahead of myself because this is something that's quite interesting. The latest report we got is that the grapes in Coachella are $4 less than last year in the market. That's a pretty significant thing. We don't know if it's a boycott. I would like to believe it's a boycott. I don't know. But it's, I don't know of anything else that would, it's $4 less. It's going for $12.
Yeah,
going for $16. Huh?
Ben told me that here last night.
Yeah. So, but we need to, we need to let people know. There's a lot of confusion between, when you say grapes, people think it's wine too, and raisins, you know. Almost everybody, so we have to keep saying it's only fresh table grapes.
Mm-hmm.
And we're using the word fresh grapes because that's what the industry uses now.
Mm-hmm.
And no wines. We're not boycotting wines and we're not boycotting the raisins.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they're three separate industries.
Right. When you think back over the history of the ALRA, was there enough help when it was working to have been good, and would you have wanted it to happen again?
Well, you know, it's kind of a hard question to answer because you're measuring two things. You're measuring the expectations because of the law. The law is a very, very well written and an extremely good law. In fact, if you compare the ALRB with any other labor law in the United States, or any other labor law in any state, it would be far superior for the workers. It is a workers law. In fact, the preamble states all this is by design because when we drafted the law, we looked into every possible contingency we could think of. We couldn't cover all of them, but the law even says that. It's for the purpose of helping farm workers organize. That plain.
Mm-hmm.
Now, but when you get into the real world of politics, of course, it's a far cry from ever being implemented. And even under the best of conditions, the law suffered a lot of political, problems. Even under Brown, you know, when we were at our best in terms of organizing. They cut the legislature cut the budget off, which really cut the winds from under our sails because we were on a real high, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then, even in terms of actually getting money from the growers, not even under the Brown administration would we be able to get the damages for workers. It's still pending, you know. So that I would take it again, even with all those problems under a good administration, but. My judgment, and I would not take it under an adverse administration, but at this point I feel that unless the law could somehow be set up as an independent agency to really get away from the wind, from the political winds that blow in California every 4 years. What happens is we'll just keep the courts jammed with appeals. If the courts should change, which will change someday, then it'll be even worse. Right now, at least we've had a good court, but that may not be the case. So if you have a bad law and a bad court, the only hope we have, the only hope is like, we don't really have a law. In fact, it's at this point it would be better not to have a law than to have what we have and how it's working. But the only, I try to search all of the options, but the only real way I think this union, and I'm beginning to think a lot of other unions are going to make it, is by going out to its publics, going out to those groups of consumers that support us and get them to keep supporting us. Otherwise, I don't think we'll ever make a real sustainable progress. Because the law's not working, you know, of all the things you've heard that are wrong, probably the worst thing now is that we have a full-scale gimmick for many growers in the country to go out of business. In fact, we just got word another big one is going out. And we're like, we don't know what to do with them, because we know it's illegal, we know that it's a gimmick, but the law's not working.
Because there is something in the law that was supposed to cover that, right?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. Very.
But that
very
has good. Not worked.
Even under Jerry Brown, we never got it to work once, because it's an enormous amount of investigation. It would be like having to trace. See, what happens is that some of the development in agriculture is developed not for agricultural sake, but it's developed for investment sake. But agriculture has becomes a byproduct of the real estate tax write-off schemes, you know. And when you're dealing with that kind of stuff, which is getting more and more, then all that is susceptible to tremendous changes from one day to the other. Mm-hmm. And we're plagued right now. That's one of our biggest problems. The other problems are big, but we at least think we have a solution for them. This one, we haven't found the. We don't know how we're going to deal with it.
And thinking back over the development of the union as a nonviolent action organization, I was wondering how the passage of the ALRA affected the action program, because I know that the boycott stopped when the law went into force. Was that action program diverted to some other place, or how did you see that?
Well, you see, before the ALRB, things were a lot easier for us because we didn't have to do this boycott. Mm-hmm. And then we didn't have that many contracts, and what we had we could handle. When the law came in, it expanded. We couldn't have done it any other ways. We had to call off the boycott, because we resources-wise, we opened up a whole field of organizing, completely different way of doing things. Now, before we had to convince people and welcome this, now we could go and get involved for the union, which is completely two different ways of doing business. Mm-hmm. And then, together with the law came in this enormous other work, which is the law, and we had to have paralegals and attorneys, and we've spent more money in the legal department since the law started than we have in any other thing. That's how ridiculous the thing got, so that we were, now I say, with hindsight, I say we were drawn to a different battlefield, mm-hmm. one which was not ours, you know. And if we compare all the money we put into the law and what we've been able to get out of it with all of the energies we put into it, we would have not tried to use the law the way we tried. We tried to appeal everything. Mm-hmm. Well, everything that was wrong, everything that was where the grower was breaking the law, we challenged everything. And a good 80% never came through because of all of the intermediary layers of people who run these agencies. And well, you know, a lot of those people have, you have a guy who is a plain, pretty ordinary fellow, and he gets put in one of these positions. And if he's alive, if it's the slightest bit prejudiced or afraid, the workers, they will all tend to judge against the workers. Mm-hmm. You see, there's a lot of fear against the growers, and it takes exceptional people to run the law. I mean, at all levels, mm-hmm. like even investigators, an example. All the way up to the governor and up to the highest council, which would be the board itself, mm-hmm. and the general council, which is the key. But there's a lot of fear. That there is not that fear to the workers. The only thing we have going for us is that there may be some commitment to justice, but that wears thin with pressure from fear and growers and so forth. So we have seen, for instance, very low level bureaucrats. I mean, extremely low level Democrats too, coming and making decisions affecting the whole workforce. It's an amazing example. We just had one. There's a strike at Cellular American Farms, the second largest farm in California. And we're telling this bureaucrat, we're saying, we don't want to vote in the company property. We're on strike, how can we go to company property? And we don't want to ride in the company's buses. And as much as our people argued and screamed and everything he could, his mind was made up. You go on the company buses, subjecting the workers to all the harassment from the foreman, and you vote in company property. How in the hell can that be a free election, in my estimation? See, I think that, but it's no different. Because you take every single law, every law that has been written for poor people, and I'm speaking specifically a labor law like ours, and labor law for other workers, industrial workers, and the Civil Rights Act, just as an example. Every damn thing has been written. When it gets down to the implementation, it gets thwarted, gets taken away, gets diluted, doesn't happen, you know. Now, every single piece of social and labor legislation affecting workers, farm workers, which isn't much, but everything is broken. See, there's no enforcement. It's just like, I often wonder, the growers really are it's hard to describe the growers, the growers' view of legislation for workers. It's very, I mean, you know, it doesn't exist. As far as I can see, it doesn't exist. That's why so many of the growers under the ALRB are in deep trouble if the money's ever collected, with millions of dollars, because it's this mentality that the law's never been enforced. True, nobody ever went up to try and get a law enforced as we did. We spent millions of dollars and thousands of hours, you know, and efforts and politics. We did everything trying to enforce the law. That piece of legislation for farm workers got more attention than any other law in the history of the country dealing with workers and other laws. So that we had the growers still with this frame of mind that somehow the laws don't really affect us, and somehow we get out of them. And that mentality, you know, facing us, it's pretty enormous, you know, with all of the stuff with the politics and the bureaucracies. By the time we get out, by the time we start with a gush, and by the time we get into to the end, we have a trip. It's pretty amazing. And then we have a whole bunch of, what's amazing too is that we have a governor who built his career on law and order. I mean, you look at his record, law and order all the way through. I mean, just amazing. And here he's not only not enforcing, we think he's breaking the law in the process of doing what he's doing. We're pretty sure that if we had an attorney general worth its salt that there will be charges brought against, at least against some of the, at least like against the general counsel, because we know he's breaking the law. I mean, everybody does. I mean, it's no secret. But of course, there'll never be any prosecution there. And so that, the other amazing thing is that we have a group, we have a group in this state who is really above the law. Really, I mean, the law doesn't really, I mean, the courts have acted, everything is taking place. We've run through the whole gamut, every step, you know, all the Anglo-Saxon way of doing things, and the decision has been made, and now nothing happens. So that, for instance, as an example, we said, well, you know, we should have won that election because we did. I mean, we should have won the election. If the election had been free and people had not been fired, had not been scared, we should have won the election. In fact, we went in with 90% of the people signed up. And we have the vote and we lose by 45 to 55% or 40 to 60%. Well, you know, administration, any group of reasonable people will see that unless the elections are really totally free, you really can't win the election. It's very difficult. Because it has nothing to do with whether people want the union or not want the union. That's not the issue. That should be the issue. The issue is, do I want the union badly enough to be fired? And so then we say, well, gee, you know, we're going to file. And we file against, this just to show the layer of protection that the growers have, because the more effort we put into try to protect our interest and try to make the damn thing free and fair, the more protection they get. So they break the law. That's illegal. We file and we put all the attorneys and put all the work. Just because we have filed, and the case is going to take between 3.5 to 5 years, but just because the case is pending, we cannot have an election again until that happens. Mm-hmm. If we didn't file, we could have an election in a year.
So it really does, in some ways, really does damage an action program.
Well,
if you play that field.
If we do, and we have played that field, I mean, to the hilt, that we went out and left no stone unturned to try and get the full measure of the law applied, you know. As I said, even under the best of administrations, it's not going to happen. It's just not made in this society, in this capitalist society. It's not made for laws to really, really fully protect workers. Not the way the law is written, but what's in people's minds, all of us, since we grow up and we live in, you know, in that kind of atmosphere, I think.
Well, I interviewed you in early 77. You were hoping at that time to be able to develop the economic base of union from farm workers. And, of course, there was a lot happening as far as getting contracts and so on. What's the financial status now?
We did I think in 77, this is just by memory. In 77, yeah, by the middle of 78, the dues were paying for about 85-87% of the expenses of the union. And by the end of 78, we were pretty much there, and by 79, definitely. By the time the letter strike came in, we were above the, we were now bringing enough dues to carry out our work. And, but that is without the boycott, which is another whole dimension, you know, another whole big expense. In fact,
right.
the boycott expense, when it gets full blown, you know, it could equal. Well, in fact, during the big boycott days, the boycott budget was 2 and 3 times higher than the union budget. But it could equal very easily the union budget. So, and then, of course, I said that without talking about the strike fund. When we get into what we call now the nonviolent action fund, we had to borrow money. We didn't have quite enough to do the work. So, in this last 9 years, we learned a lot, you know. And I don't... That's the same place labor is now and has been for a long time, with one more dimension that those poor guys are going through. But the... I don't really think that we as a union or any other union can progress under the law. If the law was applied equally, we could. We could, because the whole concept of the law is there. But the way the way they've got labor fractured is pretty, I mean, it's unbelievable how unions cannot really help unions. In the boycott, they can't see. But in traditional, like, strike, that kind of activity, organizing, striking, boycott, the traditional boycott, or using, for instance, the Safeway clerks refusing to handle a product because their brother's out in the field picking grapes. That can't be done. That's illegal. Well, that's a good stretch of the imagination. They came in with a secondary boycott, and people believe it's evil. But they never knew that an employer here, a great worker here, and a great worker here can cross money, can steal labels, can cheat the public about labels and about and give money to each other and support. No, there's no regulation, absolutely, what they can do against a union. But two unions cannot help one another one with their real resources. Not the solidarity pledges. No, I'm talking about the boycott. People refusing to handle products because they're not organized. The unions don't have that. And unions have... They don't... So... we're a product of that. And those laws came when the workers were rioting. I think it's going to get to that. I think it'll be more. The more they drive labor into a corner, that is, the more they drive the workers into a corner. Really, then there'll be that reaction again, where they start going to the streets. And labor is fed up right now, and I don't know how much longer it'll take, but they're having a difficult time. And I mention it because I know. Although by and large we're made an exception. People do not look at us as a labor union. And all of the bad feelings that people have against unions are not visited on us, and thanks God for that. But still, we're concerned because we see the management as an example, but with no limit, like saying, well, we'd like to limit unions to here. There's no limits. The people who are doing this want to destroy labor movement. And that could be, we know that's a dangerous, dangerous thing for the country. It's a dangerous thing. I mean, it's just, it can't be. So anyway, they've taken a cue from that, and the ones who are dealing with us are the same people now. Because the growers, no, they came in, and because they're for hire, they're applying all the same tech, you know, except that one of the things that we have going for us is that they have not fully been able to do the job on us that they did, and they're trying, and boy, they've got a plan, I'm telling you, that they've done on labor. See, they've done a atmospheric, I think that's the word that Richard used, an atmospheric campaign on labor, so that everybody believing that labor is corrupt, big labor leaders, you know, labor, the whole question, every day they raise a question, the same thing, is labor viable? Do we need labor unions, labor bosses? If you look to see how well the campaign is, every time there's a big labor doing, like say the FLCO meets, in that week, by the end of that labor meeting, you will find an article all over the country with two or three or four pictures of labor leaders and the same subtle question: is labor viable? Unions are losing. They're on their way out, you know. And that labor just began to understand that, and they're just now beginning to kind of fight back, you know. And this same campaign they have against us, and we got to fight on that other, and that media. No, it's not a media. It's really like a conditioning. They precondition the public, mm-hmm. and of course we're definitely afraid of that because then the boycott wouldn't work.
Just to conclude that question about finances, what's the current situation? What percentage of your budget is raised from dues?
I think we're about even now. But if we put in the boycott, then we don't have enough money because the boycott's starting up again.
Yeah.
And then with these large companies supposedly going out of business or doing what we call a corporate reshuffle,
yeah.
they really don't go out of business. They just pretend to get out of the union. It's probably be... We had anticipated even 6 months ago that we would be in the red. But luckily we stayed kind of even.
I want to ask you some questions about the union's organizing. Just some current statistics. How many workers are under contract currently?
Well, not counting some of the big companies that have gone out in the last 6 months, we're estimating about 43 or so thousand jobs, and that may be less now with those companies going out.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have a count yet. The only thing we have is from the medical plan or anything else. And that doesn't count all of them, just counts the ones that qualify.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But a whole bunch of people work, you know, in the same job. We make a projection that in California, every job takes about 1.9 workers. That's kind of my estimate. And if we kind of... use that as a figure, and then put in take in these wild work situations we have, like in Coachella, where to do 8,000 jobs, it'll take about 30,000 people. It's unbelievable. There and then Lamont, which is even more radical that way, where Lamont we might have 12,000 jobs and about 40,000 people come. That's because people, I don't really know, but it's like the same people in Coachella, 50% of the people are working there last week. This mm-hmm. is last week, and I expect to be there this week. It's just like a tumbling process.
Mm-hmm. They just move on to do something else.
Yeah. They do. It's because it's, I think what's happening is the workforce is specializing itself. I think there's a drive, I don't really know, but for instance, I know that the people who do the people who do some of the activities in Coachella, which would be like the girdling. Those people going from, they go from here, from the valley,
mm-hmm.
from the San Joaquin Valley, in droves up there. That's all they do. It's only about a week and a half, 2 weeks at the most. And that you have a
They're
set of
girdling
about...
girdling specialists.
Yeah, yeah. It's piece rate, that's all they want to do. Because mm-hmm. they have their jobs here or other things, maybe.
How about in other states? How many contracts in other states?
Just Florida, we have one. And we had one for a long time. And that's... But in other states, the union is still at the development, at the first phase of the development. You know, we're doing... Well, we don't have members in terms of paying dues, but we have members in terms of people following and being mm-hmm. involved in the legislative campaigns and the political campaigns. And we're having some good luck there, you know, especially in Texas and some in Arizona. There's a lot of there's a lot of movement, even in California. If the thing keeps going the way it is, we will probably touch every worker in the state would have had a connection with us, even though they're not in a union contract. It's amazing how many people also leave agriculture who are under, who were our members. I mean, it's just like a constant resupplying people in agriculture, and then they move up. Say they move, if they stay in the area, they move into the better jobs, because once they're there, they position themselves and they get into the canneries or the frozen foods or the packing sheds and so forth. Mm-hmm. And then they're replaced by new immigrants, by another wave, and it just keeps moving, you know. So at the cannery level, at that level, I was talking to a group yesterday in Gilroy, and I was amazed that out of about a group of 800 workers, according to the people I was talking to, about 80% were members that actually work on a union contract in Salinas. Mm. And they said that's, you know, that's pretty much so.
I've heard some about the Como Siempre campaign and about the ads, and I wanted to know what were some of the other dimensions of that as an organizing campaign.
Well, we started working harder in organizing after the law came back, was in 77, I believe. We tried harder to organize, and we progressively did, lost more elections, and got, and those, the ones that we won, we were getting less percentage of the workforce. Mm-hmm. And we're saying, we couldn't believe, we couldn't understand it. And we would go into a place like most companies, and so we're not going to file until we have 90% to be sure. And we file 90%. And we have the election and we lose the election. And we say, how in the world can these people, they know us. I mean, they know who we are. How can they believe the company lies and vote against us? And the thing was that when they voted against, they were not met with a union. There wasn't like, with a few exceptions, it wasn't that they were really hated. They just voted against the union. So we said, well, how in the world? What really brought it to a head was about 2 years ago, when, or 2.5 years ago, we had an election where there were 60 workers, and a good 50 workers were union members who were laid off and working there, and we lost the election. And we started looking at the names, and we knew the people weren't the same names, different names. And you want to take it off? You want?
Sure.
Let me go off the record. The other thing is that the employers brought in professional union busters, as they're called, you know, and they did a job on us for several years. For instance, you just give me an example. Let me give you an example of how ridiculous the damn thing is. We come into a place where workers are getting $3.35 an hour, or say $3.80 or $4, and these are the most extreme cases. And right across the street would be a grower organized getting $7 an hour. No benefits here, and loaded with benefits here. And people know each other. And we went out and we talked about the wages and about the conditions and the medical plan. And we just talked about that. I mean, and even we do leaflets showing side by side how much they were losing. Mm-hmm. And the employer would come back and just talk about dues, talk about every time you organize a farm, they go out of business, that kind of stuff. Those two things, and we lose the election. We didn't understand. So we just did an election in Salinas that we lost by a narrow margin. We didn't talk about wages. We didn't talk about medical plan. We just talked about, it was an issue, just an issue of losing the jobs and the company that came with its promises. We went from about 8% to almost winning the election in 3 weeks. And this is the new Como Siempre campaign, mm-hmm. just open our eyes that what they've been doing is, see, they've been applying the political campaign tactics have been applied against us for all these 5 years, and we didn't know what they were doing. Now we're using the same tactics, and como siempre is a whole campaign involving packaging the union. In fact, instead of saying, well, we have better medical plan, we have better wages and all that stuff, you don't do that because that doesn't really sell it. And then a survey was done last year, which a pretty scientific survey conclusively proved to us that the worker who's not on a union contract, even though he's getting bad wages, is not thinking about bad wages. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. They're thinking about favoritism, discrimination, or the boss, pressure from the boss to produce more. So here we've been all these years talking about wages and money and conditions. Now, once they're organized, then it changes radically. Then that's a campaign. Mm-hmm. Then it's wages and all that. Mm-hmm. But before they're organized, we couldn't believe that. And although we were told by the experts that was what's happening. So the Como Siempre campaign is a long-term campaign to give you an example, just one example. I heard about 5 years ago from some of the staff who come back in a campaign and say, the grower, you know what this son of a gun did? No. Well, he told the workers that you live in a mansion, and we lost the election because of that. And I said to myself, I can't, you know. They do. Nothing to do with the election. I live in a mansion, or I have a jet, or I have a bank account in a... Those are the issues. The issues are personalized. So that's what we did last week. We personalized issues against the vice president in charge of the farm. It's a big corporation, but the vice president. In fact, we went all the way to challenge him to a debate, and we knocked him out of the water. We lost the election because they fired people, and the company made tremendous promises they won't be able to keep. And the workers, after we lost the election by 60 votes out of almost 1,000 votes, our people went back the next morning, and they were thanking us. The workers that voted against him saying, thank you. Thank you for helping us. That's the mentality. Thank you for helping us, because they know that if we had not been there, the company would have, because they were about to fire them. And see, what they do is they bring labor contractors to do the work because they do it cheaper. And they're doing that all over the place. So anyway, the Como Siempre campaign deals with the atmospherics. We're dealing now with this, my house, you know. Mm-hmm. So we have an app that just shows what my house is. I'll just keep repeating it and repeating it and repeating it and repeating it, you know. And then we're dealing with those things that we think are out in the atmosphere out there that people tend to believe, so that when we come into a campaign, those issues are no longer issues for the employer. They can't use them because we have kind of set an atmosphere for that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they'll come up with others, I'm sure. But that's how campaigns are run.
Where was this place that you, in Salinas, that you just... What ranch was it where you just lost it?
Hanson Farm, where we could never go there. We could never... The workers are friendly enough, but they never... See, the Hanson Farms, when we organized the Salinas, the heyday of Salinas, he went up and increased the wages, just the wages, mm-hmm. no benefits, and up to part of the union. And he got away with it for years. And the workers there thought that they were in heaven. Boy, when Hanson sold to Kessel and Cook, and Gelson came in and told me that on today, the 15th, I guess, huh?
16th.
Okay, yesterday, the company took over. In March or April, they told him that, actually, I think it was early May, that they were going to lay off they were going to subdivide the farm or something. And the workers really got frightened and ran over to the office. The workers also used this to negotiate. See, every year, the workers have their own little organizing effort for more wages, and they tell the company, "We're going to get wages. We're going to get Chavez." Mm-hmm. All those interplays, and it's a very complex world. Mm-hmm. But
Teamsters were in that election too.
Oh yeah,
they got their ass kicked.
Oh boy, it is amazing. They came in. We think what happened with the Teamsters came in. They're still working with the companies, but not as, they're a little more careful now because of the law. Mm-hmm. But they came in to force us into an election so they could get rid of us. And the teachers forced the election. They're the ones that filed for the election. They got 33 votes. 33 votes out of 1,000. There's a big fight right now for an Ed Local. There's another group trying to take over, and they were laughing. That's what I met with yesterday. They were laughing about what we did to the teachers. And then getting back to Como Siempre then, so we're now doing TV ads, surveys, both the survey that was done before. Now we're doing also mail surveys and mail, direct mail, a lot of radio. And it works. We haven't won one yet, but we know we're going to win them. It works. It's a new technique. I mean, like it opens up our eyes to, for instance, that the labor consultant Sanchez that we took on at Hanson had destroyed us. All he does is he has a leaflet. It's like a cemetery, right? All these crosses, and the crosses is the name of the company. We're not a business. Mm-hmm. Most of those we say are, you know, corporate reshuffles to get out of the union and the year, you know. All of them. And all he does is just says, you want the union? This is going to happen to you. And he beat us. That's all he does. And sometimes he gets desperate, put in the union business, you know, or the political fund. They call labor consultants. But they act like a political consultant. They come in, they're experts in having the union, the workers vote against the union. And they get away with murder because the unions are pushing for their program. Like, you would think that you offered them a better wage. They would not do that. So we learned that. And now we're now trying to counteract that. And we're excited because we're beginning to see the great possibilities. And also in this campaign, this guy, Sanchez, has been like, he goes in there and we know. We're leading 80%, 85%. He comes in. Now, weak time destroys everything. And this time was so bad that he left. He wouldn't come to the fields. The people wouldn't talk to him. And the boss wouldn't come to the fields. What they did, they went out and then, because he was doing all the campaigns, what he does, he up in front talking to workers. It was so bad that they couldn't do anything. So then they met and they got the foreman to go in. And they assessed the crews and they said, okay, in this crew, there are 36 people. We know this crew is a good crew for us, but nevertheless, there's about 8 people here for the union. They're going to get fired if they vote for the union. Because, see, you can count votes pretty well. Mm-hmm. And then they go to, and then the crews where they were overwhelming union, they wouldn't touch those. They just go for they had the majority and get more, mm-hmm. too. And then because you can count votes almost to the last. It's amazing how you can predict, you know. And, so they use that's against the law. I mean, you know, how can you have a free election? How can you have a free election if people have to choose between their jobs and the union, which is not the issue? The issue is whether they want a union or not. So in the great boycott, the demands that we have are different because of that. We're saying the great boycott will come off when the industry in grapes meets two demands. One is that they will set up so we can have free and fair, no interference in the elections. And if we win the election, then they bargain in good faith. Pretty much what the law says.
Yes.
But which it's not doing. So we're saying we have to boycott to get that protection that we should have under the law. But the law is so uncertain and there's so much insecurity about the law that we ever got a lot of consideration. We thought, well, that's probably our best way of doing it, is just go and lock up the industry and do it. It's a new innovation saying we want a pre-contract. Before we get to a labor agreement, we want another contract between us and the industry that says they'll not interfere in elections. And if they don't interfere, we should win most of them. If it's just up to the worker without the pressure of losing a job or you know, or being, what other pressure? Losing a job? Without that pressure, from the surveys we've done, about 72 to 78% of people would vote for the union. That's now. And if we campaign, probably raise it a little higher. It's very complicated. I mean, it's not.
It's very, very complicated. Yeah. This is the first explanation I've had. I mean, none of it comes as a big surprise, but I just haven't been able to really picture.
Well, the press. See, let me tell you what's very interesting. Most of the labor writers know beans about this. They don't know what they're talking about, and you can't explain it because they got in their mind, well, you lost and they won, therefore the workers don't want you. And we're saying, God, we go through the whole explanation, but they don't understand. Now, the employer, the labor consultant understands very well, and we understand very well. We know this, the game's going on. But the outside world really, really can't. So, they'll do their really sophisticated campaign. If it doesn't work, then they resort to breaking the law. Because as I said, breaking the law helps them. Can you imagine? Ordinarily, we would come and have an election the next year. Well, because now we filed to protect grievances against... Now, you can't have an election because it's going through the courts and it takes 5 years. So you got a 5-year immunity for breaking the law. We have to find different ways of doing it.
I'd like to pick up on something else that you talked a lot about when we met in 77. And that was concerning the development of community, first for the staff, and then you were projecting way up the line toward the membership. And I'd be interested to know how things have developed in these 9 years, and what your thinking is currently.
Well, community has had a bad name, There's been some things that have happened, like the Jones thing and others,
mm-hmm.
the Synanon and other cult kind of things, mm-hmm. And we've been hit hard by the press, so we've been kind of shy,
Mm-hmm.
I still maintain that, especially for the staff, that short of developing a community. Well, let me put it this way. I know that the community has tremendous strength, and it's a kind of like a spiritual force. It's hard to judge. It's hard to even describe. But you can sense it. It's there. It keeps us together through thick and thin, and it's tremendous amount of security. I think the way it works in La Paz, although it's still very, it's a community of sorts, I think. I think what makes a community is that the ones that get here and stay here are the ones that, we have one thing in common is that we're not salaried, we're volunteers, so that's a strong bind. And I think what happens is that because of the physical setting and because of that social commitment, it brings a lot of security to kids, and I think it kind of floats up from the kids to the parents. I think that without even realizing it, kids, and I make it a point to kind of try to understand try to look at the difference between kids who come to visit and kids who live here. The ones who live here are in a way different. I mean, different in that they are very secure kids. And kids come from the outside. They come here, and the moment they hit La Paz, they're like wild goats. They're all over the place, like little birds, And their parents say, they never do that at home. And most of them don't want to go. They say, can we stay here? But you see, and I think that a lot is because they, as creatures, know, say, they understand security. I mean, I'm talking about maybe physical security, right? And they sense something because they to be more prone to sensing that than an adult. They have less things to worry about. So I think that the same thing is true of the children who live here. And from that, it works up to the parents. And so community would do that kind of. Now, Because it's very extremely voluntary, you know, voluntary, so we have still people who, as I say, still like to stay in their caves quite a bit. Mm-hmm. We don't really like to, they're not, some of us are very social, you know. We want to be among people. I mean, that's how we live, you know. And some people don't, they want to be by themselves, but they're still here. Mm-hmm. But we have not really, I think we progressed. The community has strengthened itself, but it's been kind of by the impact of time, the passage of time has on all of us who live here. So it's stronger that way, mm-hmm. but not because of design, not because we've gone out and although I guess in a way I do more than most, you know, try to have affairs and events and so forth here that'll kind of bring them together. But I still would like to do it. And see, there's a lot of criticism from the labor unions are not. Labor unions are not, well, it's strange, you know, even in the community, you know, why don't you go out there and see, people don't realize that unions and church, hey, we're all, it's people. And we're basically dealing with people, not dealing with unions or churches or growers, we're dealing with people. That's the basic ingredient. And, we've talked about developing, mini La Pazes in other parts of the country where boycotters could live, you know, and then work out of. We're thinking about one for the, New York, New Jersey, New York area. We talk about one for the New England area, but, you know, it's just talk. We're not doing it. Yeah. And here, we've talked about for the staff outside La Paz. And it'll probably happen sooner. And it might happen just because economically, when we compare how we live here with our staff that lives on the outside, it's really very economical living in La Paz for the union, mm-hmm. as compared to living in Salinas, where people would, an average rent would be $600-$700. An average rent here is $150. So that it may come because of economics. There are some people, more people now, that would probably like to do it, especially the older leadership. Not all, but some. Mm-hmm. See, what we have two. We have people who really want to do it, people who don't want to do it. We don't have anybody in between. It's pretty amazing. The younger people, single people, tend to be a lot more for the whole idea of being together, eating together, and all that stuff. The older single people tend more to be by themselves. And then the families, well, you know, it's half of one and six of one, half a dozen of the other.
In Jacques Levy's book, you made some reflections about Gandhi. And I wrote down one of the things, you know, a reflection you had. You said, he had tremendous discipline, both personal and around him. He had all kinds of rules and insisted they be obeyed. So a group of 30, 40, or 100 men at the most was very effective because they worked like a symphony. They were totally loyal to him. He wouldn't put up with anybody being half loyal or 90% loyal. He was 100% loyal or nothing at all. And I know that Gandhi has had a really big impact on you, and I want to know if that's been an important idea in your mind as you've worked to shape the staff.
Well, it's, you know, it's been one of the influences because of tremendous work that he did. He was by the time that India got its independence, he was about the only really truly national white organization in the country. People don't see it. People see Gandhi as one human being sitting there and creating miracles. He had an enormous organization. Mm-hmm. That's where the idea of the volunteers come. Enormous, I mean, thousands of people. And he raised millions of dollars. What comes to the Western world is this saintly man sitting there and somehow have miracles. Mm-hmm. He has an organization. He was probably the best fundraiser the world's ever known. Mm-hmm. But people don't look at him. See, they don't even look at it. He had hordes of people, volunteers working. And there was a lot of discipline. If not to him, at least to the ideal, you know. And it was a tremendous moral force, spiritual and moral force, so that we can learn a lot from the organizing abilities. He had tremendous organizing abilities. And all in the... He did it the way it should have been in India, supposed to in those days, without the help of any of the inventions, you know. He didn't even have a... it's amazing. To hold a large rally with, say, 3 million people, and to have him heard, everybody was there with him without a PA system, is pretty unbelievable, the organization that it took. I know he spoke in half a whisper most of the time, so that it was so organized that that thousands of people carry his voice, you know, like he said, and then they would repeat it, and repeat it, and repeat it, and repeat it, and repeat it. So when he got through speaking here, there was still a good half hour, the chain was taking place. Mm-hmm. And he could have probably had a PA system if he wanted one, I suppose, but wouldn't. Because he felt that every time you brought in, like, a new invention, a new piece of equipment, that then you... If you did that, then you would somehow... that became more important than... that became more important than human beings, you know, like all of his arguments for the village industries and cottage industry, all that stuff. So there's a lot to learn from him. There's a lot to learn from him.
Did the idea of the 100% loyalty, do you feel that that's an important thing in this organization?
Oh, no. See, we live in a completely different time, and we live in a completely different time, and it's not India for sure, and it's, I think that in terms of when I was speaking of loyalty, I speak of loyalty towards the union. I think that either you're loyal or you're not loyal, see, because in we have a very well-defined philosophy in the labor movement. You know, it's philosophy is very simple, very straightforward. It's either you believe in the workers' rights or you don't, you know, and it's not halfway. I mean, and when I speak of philosophy, I speak about either if you believe in the workers' rights, then compromising. That compromising, which unfortunately happens many times to the detriment of the workers in other places, we don't want that. That's why I speak of loyalty, because what happens is that the workers know. And I speak specifically of the workers want to do something, and you know damn well it's wrong. And that's where you have to make the decision. That's what I'm saying is they want a strike, and you know that they may not win the strike, or you know that they're really the strike. Well, you're not sure whether a strike is the best thing to do, but they want the strike. And I'm saying, you better damn well help them with a strike. No strings attached. You go help them. That's your commitment to. That's the loyalty that we talk about. Otherwise, it doesn't matter whether it's right or wrong. That doesn't matter. What matters is that they want it. Mm-hmm. They want to do it, and they need your help. They need the organization to help them. And that's where organizations, unions get into trouble, because the leadership begins to make those adjustments, you know, because they know best. Mm-hmm. Well, let me tell you my experiences. Even if you go and lose that strike, but you help them, they're with you. They're with you. I mean, you help them. If you don't have the loyalty of the workers before you, then you start making a decision like those workers weren't saying, "Come and we want to win the strike." Sure, they would want it. And if you don't win the strike, we're going to make you responsible. They weren't saying that. They were saying, come help us. See the difference? Mm-hmm. And to do that, you have to have tremendous loyalty to the workers. And to have loyalty, you got to have, I mean, to have loyalty, it's got to be complete loyalty, otherwise you can't do it. Let me give you another example. Probably, it sets it better, and this is the context that I was saying, that I was talking to Jacques. We were told by many unions in the early days of the union that don't let the workers make the demands because they're crazy and they're going to wreck the union. You do them. And coming from the kind of background Dolores and I came from, community organization, total involvement, total democracy, and that kind of, it was hard for us to take that advice, and we didn't. And we soon found out. And in fact, in the very first contract that we were up to negotiating, the workers were getting $1. They were getting 75 cents an hour. Or 65 cents an hour, they wanted $3 an hour. That's like a 500% increase. We knew, not that they didn't deserve it, we knew they were not going to get it, but they were insisting. And they had their meetings, and they had about 600 workers, and they screamed, and they argued, and they voted, and it went through. And we said, okay, we'll do it. We will do it. That's what they want. We'll do it. And we did it with the best maybe we didn't really believe it, but we did it because the whole idea of this loyalty to them. And when we made the proposal to the company lawyer, who is a very, very seasoned, extremely able, experienced negotiator, looked at it and reached in his pocket and gave us a calling card and said, when you get serious about negotiations, call me. And they were about... The committee was about 20 people on the committee, and I was there. And I didn't say anything. I just stayed there. And he walked on. And nobody said anything for it. I'm telling you, at least 15, 20 minutes, just a lot of clearing of the throats. And we just stayed there finally. And what do we do now? Because, see, they now knew that it was their move. So I turned around and I said, we can force them to give us that money. Putting up, they had just come off a big strike by going back on strike and trying to force them to give us that money. We can do nothing, go home and forget about the union, or we can try to scale down our demands. And we learned fast. We got a contract, but see, if we had said no to the workers at that point, we'd have been that's what I'm talking about loyalty. We'd have been disloyal to them because we weren't following what they wanted. Let them learn. Mm-hmm. They're not them. And in fact,
closer to you than to me, so. I'd like to have some information about the new great boycott that I have not gotten yet. I'd like to know, for instance, if it's going to be of all grapes, all fresh grapes.
Yes, it's all fresh grapes, except that small percentage.
One of the criticisms that I've read of the union is that La Paz is too isolated for the workers. And I was just thinking, as you're talking about your feelings about the workers, what do you think of that criticism? How does that work out? I mean, it is a way, it's up here, but...
Well, since people don't understand that we're not... Our main job is not dealing with the workers' everyday problems. That's, you know, they're layers of responsibility in the union. We're a national organization now, and as it turned out, not because it was planned, as it turned out, there were a lot of factors in the decision to move up. One was straight out of economics. Somebody gave this piece of land, and you know, we needed a place to grow. But the other thing was that there were some complaints, some rumblings, and some very, very they were true. Workers in other areas feeling that Delano was getting everything the union had, mm-hmm. and that we took care of Delano better because we were there. And pretty much what the founding colonies had, you know, when they sent why I set up Washington D.C. And as it turned out, we moved because we had a place here. Secondly, it's a perfect place because we're not then, we can be objective to all the units that are, all the groups of workers. But it's not because it was planned, but it happens to be in the center of California. By car, 6 hours either way, you reach the workers. The extreme two parts of California agriculture is reached here by 6 hours by car. Hmm. But that just kind of worked. And the other thing too is that when we were in Delano, you know, the workers were depending on us totally. They didn't want to do things themselves, and that's not the way the union can grow. Because we could only take care of one Delano. Mm-hmm. And our perception of how I had to do is that the workers have to develop their own leadership, they have to do it themselves. We can't do it for them. Being in Delano, we were a Delano union and not a national union. So it's worked well. It's worked for the union, I think. And nowadays, by car, we're 15 minutes from the field office in Lamont, which is, you know, it's the first chunk of workers. So it's worked pretty well, I think. And also what it does is that economically it worked perfect because we would never be able to have this kind of space in any city or in any rural area. And then also living here like in this area, like here, you can get a lot more work from the staff and from yourself. You don't have to write, you don't have to drive to work, you don't have to worry about parking, you just, a few steps and you're at your office. You know. It's a very convenient way of doing things.
It's about 5 till 10. What's your time?
I have to go to 10. At 2 minutes at 10.
Okay. Well, why don't we conclude then? And okay. I really appreciate it. It's been fun also to.
Thanks.
Good.